We're talking with political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal from death row at SCI Green in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. My name is Mike Thornton, and this is Full Logic Reverse. Mr. Jamal, things are not necessarily always as they seem, and of course, most people living in the United States these days have no idea what's going on inside the prison system. And in particular, regarding people who have quote-unquote political aspects as factors of their incarceration. I'm thinking, of course, in terms of yourself, Dr. Shakur, Marilyn Buck, Laura Whitehorn, Sekou Odinga, any number of people. Perhaps you could talk about prisons and political prisoners, if you will.
If you remember, a few years ago, it might have been, 86, maybe before, maybe a little later. A man named Andrew Young, who was a United States ambassador, once said that America has its own political prisoners. And he was lambasted for it. Politicians across the spectrum condemned his remarks. Andrew Young, being a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King and a preacher, and also a savvy politician, never ate those remarks. He never said I was wrong. He said perhaps I shouldn't have said what I said the way I said it or something to that effect. But he spoke a very powerful truth. And it's a truth that America ignores to her peril. And that's because in every state of this union, in state prisons, certainly in federal prisons to a large degree, there are people who are incarcerated for their political beliefs and their political activities. They are political prisoners or prisoners of war. And there can be no doubt of that. There are people who have had time, sentences, given to them that are only understandable when you look at it from the perspective and through the prism of politics. That means if you were to take this person and to look at what the state says they were convicted of doing, their so-called offense, and you look at another person that's convicted of a similar offense, and you see the difference, the distance in time, it is almost as if the sentence tells the tale that the rest does not. That's certainly the case with Dr. Mutulu Shakur. That's certainly the case with Geronimo Zizal. That's certainly the case with Delbert, Chucky, Merle, Eddie, and Phil, and Janet, and all the Africans, the nine people who are doing 30 to 100 years for third-degree murder in Pennsylvania. At the time they were convicted, the statute allowed 10 to 20 for third-degree murder. They ignored the statute and made a whole new law, a MOVE law, and gave people 30 to 100 years for third-degree murder. At the very least, one could say that's an illegal sentence. Of course, we know it's an illegal prosecution. But interestingly enough, you know, the sentences tell one story. And I think how people have done their time and what has happened to them in prison tells another story. The story that is told is one of repression, one of lockdown, one of physical violation, one of humiliation, one of torture, one of America's truest, nastiest face. I mean, when you look at what happened to Silvio Barodini, who the government of Italy has requested repeatedly, the Treaty of Rome requires signatories, which is United States, Rome, and other foreign countries, to adopt and follow. It requires internationals or nationals to be sent back to their host country. When you you look at, again, the sentence of a Dr. Shakur, when you look at the lockdown that MOVE women suffered for 2 or 3 years and MOVE men suffered for years and years and years, nothing but a political aroma will arise from that nastiness, that dirtiness. The other side of the coin is simply this. Evelyn Williams, who is Asava Shakur's aunt, who was a lawyer, in her book wrote about, in her experience as a lawyer, that the vast majority of people in American prisons, not a minority, not this tiny little sect group, but the vast majority of people in America are political prisoners, because when you look at how some people are treated, that is a political response. And she spoke specifically about African Americans who receive, according to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, a disproportionate degree of time, who are sentenced to heavier sentences for the exact same offenses as white defendants, you see, who are paroled less, who are less able to be taken out of the system at early avenues, you see. All of those things point to a politicization of the prisons and their use, their political function. The other thing is this. We forget sometimes. Sometimes some things are just in front of our nose and we don't see it. But no matter what state, if we were in California, of course, we couldn't be doing this interview in California right now. But if we were, okay, the entity under which you would be doing this interview and I would be interviewed is under the Department of Corrections. But what is the Department of? It is the Department of State Government. You know, it is a part of it, you see. And we sometimes forget that, and it's a powerful thing that we must remember. It is a part of a political entity, a government. And, I mean, how else can you explain my mail going not to someone in the department, but someone outside of the department, and not to another department, but to the governor's office? Duh! What's up with that?
I spoke with someone you know, Camilla Levi, a paralegal, and she suggested that I might want to ask you, talking about how departments of corrections work and operate inside prisons, about some of the things that may have been going on here recently. Can you talk about that?
Several days ago, it might have been 2 weeks ago, some things happened in the institution. There was what's a regular shakedown. And I am told through the scuttlebutt, through the men, that some drugs and a few shanks were found. Well, you know, that's not extraordinary. I mean, there are people in prison who use drugs in the street, and by hook or crook will get drugs in prison. I'm not surprised about that. Well, a few days later, there was another shakedown. And the guard found a cellular phone in somebody's cell. Well, they went ballistic. I mean, they went shaking everybody down and, you know, ripping people's stuff up and seizing this and seizing that. They had the equivalent, the prison's equivalent of a SWAT team come in, you know, body armor, baseball bats, threats, the whole thing. And they've used this as a pretext to lock down death row even further. Guys are able to be in the yard. Sometimes they're not allowed to be with anybody else. Basketball is unallowed. They're handcuffing guys behind their back, and they're walking naked men to showers with their handcuffs behind their back. I mean, it says this as if their penis is a weapon. I don't understand it. But the real reality is this, that it's kind of a unreasonable response to a provocation that is understandable. It's a broad brush painting of everyone on the road, because one man was clever enough to get a cell phone in his cell. The other side of the coin is, I mean, you don't have to be a jailhouse lawyer or a Rhodes scholar, I should say, to intuit and understand that the only way a guy could get a cell phone is through a staff member. Somebody brought it to him. But, you know, no staff has been charged, and, you know, the only people who are suffering from this are people on death row. So that's really the latest.
Do you think it was just a pretext? I know I'm surprised at the conditions we're having to conduct this interview under you behind bulletproof glass and the fact that you're handcuffed on top of that.
Well, I'm surprised that I am not belted down as I was for the last few weeks. Perhaps if you came in as a regular visit, I would be. But perhaps they didn't want the media to see that. I don't know. But I'm surprised. I thought initially that it was pretextual. I think that's a little too much. I think that's my own, you know, paranoia talking. I think they honestly did find a cell phone. But I think they're now using that pretextually to implement some security measures that they wanted to implement before that are completely unrelated to this finding, you see. I mean, handcuffing a man behind his back, walking up and down steps is dangerous. But it has absolutely nothing to do with somebody having a cell phone. I mean, what's the logic? I mean, if you can show me A and B, I ain't the smartest guy in the world, but I can get that, A, B, now C, right? And that's like taking A and then leaping to J. And I can't see that, you know. Then again, no one ever said prisons were logical, you know. They rarely work through logic, they work through power. They work through repression. And to be perfectly honest, they don't work. You know, if the meaning is to make people better, or, you know, they don't work at all. But that's the reality.
In the commentaries that unfortunately were not aired on National Public Radio, you talk about racism and the death penalty. Could you amplify on that for our audience?
Well, yeah, in this respect, I know in Pennsylvania, this is a so, this is a fact. But if you look at other states throughout the North, certainly throughout the South, what you'll find is a disproportionate number of African Americans on death row. You'll find in Pennsylvania, the African American population is about 9%. 9.3%, I think. If you look at the percentage on death row, it approaches 75% and upwards to 80%. Most of the people on death row come from Philadelphia County, one county. The next largest county is Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is, and we're not far from it, you see. We're in Greene County, near Allegheny County. And I think the number from Allegheny County is about 7. Or something like that. But if you look at it through the prism of race, you find that death rows are predominantly black in many parts of this country. And I think it has to do with this. If you look at the race of the victim in many people's cases, they're white people. When a black person is charged with homicide against a white person, all of the forces of the state come to bear. All of the forces. I mean, it becomes get rid of this person by any means necessary, fair or foul, doesn't matter. And if you walk into many of the courtrooms throughout America, you'll find a white judge, a predominantly white jury, a white prosecutor. You might find an African American defense lawyer, and I think the rest is not history, but the rest is fire and grease. The goose is cooked, so to speak. You know, in my case, and in many people's case, I mean, when you look at Philadelphia, Philadelphia, I think, has a 48, maybe 52% African-American population. It is not uncommon, even today, for someone to go to trial in Philadelphia, depending on the time of year, and go through two or three panels of jurors, and end up with a predominantly white or all-white jury in Philadelphia. And that's because, I mean, the cases and the history has shown, there are cases that have been litigated right here in Pennsylvania that have shown that, for instance, the DA's office intentionally knocked black people off. Well, I didn't want blacks on the jury. I mean, in the old days, they used to just say it like that. Now they're like, well, I don't want people from the neighborhoods, duh. You know, the point is very clear that the so-called criminal justice system is a tool of white political power and white political will. And therefore, that will is exerted against those people who are perceived as others, who are perceived as a threat to white political calmness and peace. For them, there is no constitution, there is no justice, there are no appeals, there is death and banishment to the boondocks of this state. I mean, if you were to look at this state on a map, I know you're a little tired to do that right now, and you looked at Philadelphia way over there, you would have to go to the end of the state to find Greene County. It is the farthest county in Pennsylvania. We are on the, we're really on the border of Ohio and West Virginia. If you go over the hollows down there, you're in West Virginia. You go over out west, you're in Ohio. We're that close. The logic of putting people who are on death row as far as humanly possible from their families is bizarre, you know, in the extreme. They're as far as possible from their families, they're as far as possible from their lawyers, they're as far as possible from their communities.
You talked about juries. What about judges, such as the judge in your case, Judge Albert Szabo?
Well, again, I think the operative term for someone like Judge Szabo, and this is a term that came from, not from me or from my lawyers or my people, but from people who practiced in front of him. They called him a prosecutor in robes. They called him a 13th juror. And I think, if anything, that's an understatement, you see. I think much is known, due to the media, of course, of how His Honor performed, and I must stress that he performed in my case. But he's done the same in other cases. You see, there were cases in front of him where a man is going back, let's say, for a sentencing hearing. Judge Szabo, unsatisfied with the prosecutor approach to getting a death penalty, is known to lecture the prosecutor and say, no, 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 why don't you use these aggravating circumstances here? This works, can't you read? Your Honor, you know, you want to switch places? You know, I mean, we get to a point where, in a while, you say only in Philadelphia. I mean, it's able to say that because the history is really so profound here. And it is Philadelphia, in a sense, that breeds a judge like a Szabo. I mean, he's like a Rizzo clone, so to speak. He comes from that school. But it's the city as well. I mean, there are other Szabos that you've never heard about that will never make the newspapers, but do essentially the same thing, not just in Philadelphia, but all across the country, you see. And it's kind of the supremacy of judges. I mean, you would think that a judge who swore an oath to uphold the Constitution, state and federal constitution, would say, well, there are certain things I won't do, you know, no matter how I feel about this defendant. No matter how much I'm getting paid off, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that, because the Constitution says so and so. Well, not really. Not really. And again, you know, I go back to what the former Justice Marshall said about reason not being the currency through which this court deals, but power. And power is the bottom line.
Speaking about the exercise of power, the state of Pennsylvania came very close to exercising its ultimate power over you. You were very close to being executed. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I came within 10 days of being executed. What is extraordinary is not so much that a stay occurred, although that was, I must admit, but that a stay occurred from the judge who we were in front of, Judge Sabo. It is recorded that this was the first stay entered in his, 19 or 25 year judicial career. It was eerie, let me say. You know, it was totally unexpected coming from Judge Sabo. Of course, he used that as an opportunity to further try to throttle and endanger and lock up and threaten and fine my lawyers for daring to do what defense lawyers are supposed to do, defend the client. It is also interesting to note that he used that time as well to deny the petition itself, you know, which was the core. And so it was a victory, but it was a victory that was meshed with some serious defeats.
A victory that probably would not have happened except for the worldwide protest that emerged when you were on trial.
Absolutely true.
Your notoriety certainly puts you in a unique position. And I was talking with Dr. Shakur, and his position of very often being put into the role of being a leader amongst the young African-American men in the federal prison system. And I was referred to a writing of yours where you refer to the younger men coming into the prison system here as calling you Papa. Do you see yourself as being in a position of a leadership role, and how do you deal with that?
I decline the title of leader. I think I tried to decline the title of Papa, but it just doesn't work. I mean, you get it so often. I think that's kind of one of the plums and the pluses of age. I mean, I remember, man, young guys coming to me talking about, hey, and I'm turning around, who are they talking to? I didn't know who they were talking to, because in my mind, I'm still, you know, a young guy. But that has passed, and it has passed, you know, because of the power of repetition. You know, I see so many very, very young men. I mean, I've seen men learn how to shave here, who came here and never shaved. Men grow from, you know, their teen years to their adult years here. I've seen men age and die here, of course. But he talks about, I think, that while leader is, I think, inappropriate, I think elder is appropriate. And it talks about the kind of twisted rite of passage that prisons have become in America, that men can see each other from generation to generation. I mean, every time I see a man, a young man, come in who, you know, still has milk behind his ear, so to speak, has never shaved, something burns and stings in me, you know. What is most galling, I guess, is kind of the lack of information that these guys bring with them, because they have no perception of history, no perception of their place in this world, no perception of those who came before. And therefore, you know, someone like myself, someone like my brother Delbert Africa, Chucky Africa, Mike Africa, or any of the Africas, or Dr. Shakur or Geronimo, find ourselves being papas, find ourselves being teachers, find ourselves doing what elders should have done out there in the world but haven't done, for whatever reason, out of the necessity of sharing and passing it on so people can know. John Africa says the power of truth is final. So we find that we must inform those around us. Really, whether they're young or old, but sometimes the young are more receptive. They're hungry for this information. And, you know, the feeling many of these guys have once they, you know, read a book or, you know, learn how to read or something like that, is the feeling of being cheated. They feel profoundly suckered by society. What happened is, and they didn't know it, is they bought into a false reality of who they were. They internalized the worst projection this society could dish out to them. And because they knew no better, all they could accept, all they saw around them was this negative projection. When they see themselves as they truly are, they're stunned at the level of malevolence that has been done to them, you know. And so, you know, in that respect, you know, I must just be honest about time and say, you know, I'm a papa whether I want to be. And all I can be now is just be honorable about it. You know, treat a man like he is a younger brother or a son. And give willfully and unwillingly of what you have.
And we'll continue our conversation with Mumia Abu-Jamal from Death Row at SCI Green in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, in just a few moments. My name is Mike Thornton, and thank you for tuning in to Full Logic Reverse. We continue our conversation with Mumia Abu-Jamal. What happens next for Mumia Abu-Jamal?
We continue fighting. We are fighting, continuing to fight the civil case, the criminal case, the other civil case, and any other case that may arise in the interim. A writer continues to write. A man continues to breathe and to live and to love and to grow and to learn.
Is there anything that you'd like to say as we get ready to wrap this up?
Yes, in fact there is. In a few days, perhaps in a few hours, I'm not certain, the Olympics will roll through Atlanta. And I was thinking about this huge international gathering in America's Southland, in Atlanta, in Georgia. And wondering, where are the Tommy Smiths? Where are the athletes of this age who, like Tommy Smith of my youth, energized a movement? I mean, ran not for the cereal box or the commercial gratification, but ran for their people, ran for the soul of their people, ran faster, jumped higher, leaped farther, swam swiftest, not for a medal, but for the freedom of a people. And I would want to see someone in that grouping performing their athletic best, not for a red, white, and blue banner. It really does not represent them, and never has. Not for a faux gold medal that ain't really made of gold. Not for an Olympic commission that treats them like dark cattle. But for human excellence. For a people's freedom and survival in modern day Babylon. I wonder.
Thank you, Mumia Abu-Jamal. My name is Mike Thornton, and this has been Full Logic Reverse. In the interim between now and the time that this interview was recorded at SCI Green in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal's suit against National Public Radio has been dismissed by a federal judge who ruled that while National Public Radio may have been guilty of breach of contract, they did not violate Mumia Abu-Jamal's constitutional right of free speech
by not airing the commentaries that he recorded for NPR. In addition, Judge Albert Szabo has ruled, despite the testimony of Pamela Jenkins, that Philadelphia police officers were involved in attempting to intimidate and coerce witnesses to testify to Mumia Abu-Jamal's guilt, that no credible evidence existed that should cause a reversal of Mumia Abu-Jamal's death sentence and conviction. Mumia Abu-Jamal remains on death row at SCI Green, awaiting a decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge has said that should the Pennsylvania Supreme Court rule that Mumia Abu-Jamal's conviction will stand, that he will immediately sign the death warrant, clearing the way for the execution of the voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal. My name is Mike Thornton, and this has been Full Logic Reverse. Long live John Africa.